Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, MetLife, and Grantham University. Now here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week, we'll look back at the recent Excellence in Government Conference with Congressman Jerry Connolly, Hooks Book Events President Perry Hooks, and Steve Shapiro, author of Best Practices Are Stupid, 40 Ways to Out-Innovate the Competition. But first, OurFuture.org Executive Editor Isaiah Poole joins us to preview the upcoming Take Back the American Dream Conference. Isaiah, welcome back to the program.
It's absolutely my pleasure.
Isaiah, as we mentioned, the Campaign for America's Future is hosting the Take Back the American Dream Conference coming up June 18th to the 20th here in Washington. Give us a preview of the event.
Well, the Take Back the American Dream Conference is really going to focus on how we repair the damage done by the economic collapse that conservatives precipitated before President Obama took office. And we're going to be focusing on jobs, focusing on the economy, focusing on regaining your momentum on financial reform, the war on women, and on an agenda for restoring the middle class. We will have several members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, including Congressman Keith Ellison, Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator Sherrod Brown, representatives from labor, from the women's rights movement, from the civil rights movement, and we will be pulling together hundreds of people who are working on all of these issues of economic justice and taking back our democracy.
Isaiah, that we're just about 5 months away from the 2012 election season. How important is it to have this many people working toward the same goal getting together here in Washington?
Well, there are two things that we've got to be concerned about. Of course, there's an election, and we've got to make sure that the right people are in office. So we have to give support to the political candidates who are working on an agenda that will restore the middle class, that will bring jobs back into the economy. But the other thing that we've got to do is make sure that we have a coalition that can push back against the austerity agenda that will conservatives will want to impose immediately after the elections, where we have the Bush tax cuts expiring, we have the disappearance of the payroll tax cut break coming up, a number of things that are momentous changes that, if they're done wrong, will do extraordinary damage to ordinary people. And we need a coalition that's strong enough to say, wait a minute, we need a jobs-first agenda. Our number one priority has to be putting people back to work. Our number one agenda has to be protecting the economic security of ordinary Americans and having those who are benefiting from the gradual recovery that we have to have them pay their fair share so that we can have a stronger economy tomorrow.
Isaiah, let's talk about this jobs first agenda. What is it going to take to get people, middle class workers, back to work in this country?
Well, the one thing we can't do is continue down the road of saying to millionaires and billionaires that they have no responsibility to pay, to contribute something to get this economy going again. We need a fair tax system, and we can't have our major corporations being freeloaders. In addition to that, we need to give workers a voice again. Unions are incredibly important. When we had strong unions, we had a strong middle class. As unions have weakened since the 1980s, we see what has happened to the middle class, and it's very clear. We've got to strengthen the voice of workers. And then, of course, the investments that we need in our economy to be able to have good schools, good roads, good public transit, good public infrastructure, all of the things that we need in order order to build a sound economy for the future.
Isaiah, what kinds of jobs should we be focusing on creating at this time?
I favor all of the above strategy. I mean, I think we need to restore a manufacturing base. We need to look at the green economy and make sure to recapture the leadership of the green economy. It makes no sense that we were the pioneers in the United States in solar and wind, and that's being taken from us, and we need to get back on track and make those investments, do the research, and provide incentives for the manufacturers who will take us in that direction. I think we really need to look at the trade deals that both Republicans and Democrats are supporting, which are going to end up being bad deals for workers if we don't do them right. So there are several fronts that we have to fight.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Isaiah Poole, the executive editor of OurFuture.org. Isaiah, you talked a little bit previously about giving workers a voice again, and obviously the labor movement's role in that. Talk about labor, the importance of the movement heading into this election season, as you had mentioned, to make sure that the right people are in office.
Well, Wisconsin showed us that corporations are willing to spend unlimited amount of money to break the back of unions. And they scored a devastating victory in Wisconsin by convincing people to keep Scott Walker in office as the governor of Wisconsin. I think what we need to do is to educate voters about the need to keep the scales in balance between workers and corporations. There's a relentless push to eliminate, to lower wages, to eliminate health benefits, to eliminate retirement security, and we cannot build a middle class on low wages. We shouldn't go down the route of third world economies. America has done best when its workers are well-paid, treated well, secure, and have a voice in the workplace. So that's got to be a central focus of the fight. There's one political party that has staked its future on finishing off unions once and for all. We've got to fight back.
You had mentioned this effort to push down wages, eliminate or push down retirement benefits and health benefits. That sounds like a dangerous proposition, doesn't it?
Oh, it's absolutely a dangerous proposition. And I don't know how conservatives expect to have good teachers, good public servants. And as far as the public sectors, the private sector is concerned, how we're going to actually have good workers supporting the private sector as well, if we keep going down this road. I think the fundamental problem with the rhetoric coming out from the Republican Party is by idolizing job creators. Corporations are not job creators. They're profit makers. And we need to recognize that. And we need to balance. There's nothing wrong with making profit, but we need to balance the scales. It's the reason why we've created institutions like the National Labor Relations Board, which conservatives have been trying to eviscerate, so that we can equal the scales between people who are trying to make a profit and those of us who want to work and contribute positively to the economy.
You also indicated that there was a war on women. Talk a little bit more about that and how important women voters will be coming into the election season later this year.
We saw the attacks on reproductive rights, but it doesn't stop at reproductive rights. Women still make only about three quarters of what men make earned in the economy. There was a recent attempt in the Senate to pass a bill that would begin to address that. That bill was filibustered by the Republican leadership for reasons which I can't explain other than pure politics. I think we need to, again, educate voters about the economic forces that are keeping women down. We need to also educate voters about the fact that the attack on public workers is part of the attack on women, because women make up a huge percentage of the teachers, the other public servants in state and local government that have been laid off. We need to look at the devastating impact that that has had on families and say, one of the things that we need to do is stop the cutbacks at the state and local level. Let's get these women back to work. Let's get them serving their communities again. And we can afford to do this.
When you look ahead to the 2012 election season, what do you think the single most important issue is going to be on voters' minds, not just in the presidential election, but in House and Senate races as well, and even at the state and local level?
Listen, we still have unemployment at 8% or above. In some communities around the country, the unemployment rate is in excess of 15%. When people look at their neighbors, they see people who are out of work. They also see that homes are either in foreclosure or people are underwater on their mortgages. So there is an agenda around jobs. There's an agenda around the housing crisis. There's an agenda around reining in Wall Street and doing proper putting in place proper curbs on Wall Street in the financial sector. That speaks to the unfinished agenda of the Obama administration, but also it speaks to the extent to which conservatives, the Republicans in Congress, have actually handcuffed us as a country. And we got to get out. We got to unlock those handcuffs. And the key to doing that is mobilize people.
And so you'll be addressing all of these issues and more at the upcoming Take Back the American Dream conference. Isaiah, if listeners would like to participate or learn more about the conference, where should they go to do that?
Ourfuture.org/takeback. On ourfuture.org, we will be streaming portions of the conference live, working with Free Speech TV. So we encourage people to come down to the conference at the Washington Hilton Hotel. But if for some reason you can't get to the hotel, go to our website, ourfuture.org, and you'll be able to participate online. You'll also be able to participate on Twitter at using hashtag TakeBack12.
Isaiah Poole, executive editor of ourfuture.org. Isaiah, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for taking the time today.
And thank you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll discuss the value of public service with Congressman Jerry Connolly from the recent Excellence in Government Conference.
Attention AFGE members, are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more, visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Did you know MetLife Auto and Home has valuable deals on insurance for AFGE members that could save them hundreds every year? Benefits include special discounts just for being an AFGE member, and in most states, a deductible credit for claim-free driving up to $250. To see how much you could save, call the AFGE Benefits Hotline at 1-888-844-2343 to get the members-only phone number for MetLife. That's 1-888-844-2343. Underwritten by Metropolitan Group Property and Casualty Insurance Company, Warwick, Rhode Island.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. Joined again by Congressman Jerry Connolly from Virginia's 11th District. Congressman, welcome back to the program.
Great to be back.
And so here we are today at the Excellence in Government Conference. You were the luncheon keynote speaker. What was your message that you wanted to communicate to the audience?
That public service is a noble service, and that the current narrative in this country needs to be changed, that it's not okay to disparage public service and federal employees or government workers of any kind. Those are the folks we need to serve our constituents. And the fact that some people have made short-term political hay out of doing that has long-term costs to the quality of service in America.
Congressman, how do we change that narrative?
Well, I think the public, and I think federal employees, and I think those of us in public life need to speak out and say that's not okay. When people get negative reactions and are punished, in a sense, at least with criticism, for those kinds of disparaging remarks, we're going to see and hear fewer of them.
This week starts the beginning of Public Service Recognition Week. How important is it to let public servants know the work that they do is valuable and appreciated?
I think it's very important, but it can't just be one week. I mean, it's great that we take time out to acknowledge some singular accomplishments among the workforce, but I mean, we've got to change that narrative you asked me about. We've got to make sure that the public understands that without this federal workforce, so much of the quality of life we take for granted would change and change irreparably for the worse.
What do constituents in your district say about public employees and the services they provide the American people?
Well, you know, in my district, of course, I have a very healthy number of federal employees and federal retirees. And so I think there is an understanding of what federal workers do each and every day and an appreciation for it. We need to sort of spread that understanding to other congressional districts across America. It comes as news to many members of Congress that actually the bulk of the federal workforce lives outside of the Washington metropolitan area, and that there are many federal workers and retirees in each and every congressional district doing all kinds of wonderful things on behalf of their publics. And so we need to get that word way outside the Beltway.
What have federal employees contributed thus far to helping deficit reduction?
Well, there's been a pay freeze on federal employees for 2 years, and they're talking about a third. Every pay freeze is $30 billion a year, so that's $90 billion. Federal pensions were required to cut backs in federal pensions for incoming members of the workforce were used to finance the unemployment insurance last December against my objections and that of many of my colleagues. That was another $15 billion. Federal pensions with the current workforce were cut and payments increased, costing $58 billion in transit funding for the transportation bill. So, and then there was another item for $78.6 billion out of federal compensation. So federal workforce is the only group that has been singled out to somehow pay for things that are unrelated to what they do or their responsibilities and to help reduce the debt. No such sacrifice has been asked of millionaires, of the oil and gas industry, which is making record profits, or any other group that I can think of in America.
What do some of these measures do to the federal government's ability to recruit and retain the best and brightest of federal service?
I am deeply worried about that. If you make public service an unattractive career path, how are we going to recruit the workforce of the future? 47% of the current workforce, federal workforce, is eligible for retirement sometime over the next decade. Where are we going to recruit the skilled workers we need to replace them? Why would somebody choose a law career in the federal government versus the private sector if they believe the rhetoric that we sometimes hear in the halls of Congress or elsewhere about big bloated bureaucracy, unproductive, not doing much good? Those are really reckless remarks, and they're going to do long-term damage both to the federal family and, frankly, to our constituents we need to serve. And no good comes out of that.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Congressman Jerry Connolly from Virginia's 11th District. Congressman, what's it going to take to get federal employees to feel comfortable in speaking up against some of these things?
When members of Congress have town hall meetings, I think federal workers ought to go to those town hall meetings, be recognized, and ask the member of Congress what their views are about the dignity of public service. After all, members of Congress themselves are in public service. Did you choose something consciously that you you actually deride or you have contempt for, or do you share our view? The public service is a noble calling and ought to be approached with dignity.
In your position as a member of Congress, what are your biggest challenges in addressing this issue?
My biggest challenge really is helping to educate my colleagues in Congress. Because of the familiarity with both the federal government and the federal workforce, we take a lot maybe for granted inside and just outside the Beltway. But I think we really hear some views in Congress that really show a lack of familiarity with federal employees and their issues. And that gives me hope, actually, that there's an opportunity for education and the raising of awareness and hopefully improving sensitivity to these issues.
As you look ahead to the rest of 2012, what are you looking forward to most in energizing the federal workforce?
Well, it's an election season, and I guess I'm hoping that we'll elect members to Congress and the Senate who have a deeper appreciation for federal employees and what they do each and every day for their constituents.
Congressman Jerry Connolly from Virginia's 11th District, thank you so much for your time.
My great pleasure.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue from the Excellence in Government Conference with Hooks Book Events President Perry Hooks.
I just earned my degree at Grantham University, and now I'm on my way to a promotion.
Grantham University?
The affordable online classes fit my schedule, plus I earn college credit for work experience.
How can I fast-track my degree at Grantham University?
Go to fasttrackedu.com.
Fasttrackedu.com?
Yes, fasttrackedu.com. If you're an AFGE member, you qualify for a tuition discount. Check out Grantham University today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com, joined by our good friend Perry Hooks, the president and co-founder of Hooks Book Events. Perry, welcome back to the program.
Jason, great to see you. So glad to be back here at Excellence in Government.
Excellence in Government, indeed. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing here today.
We've got a great booth set up next to yours, which is nice, showcasing some fabulous new books on leadership and management that might be really ideal for the folks attending today's conference. But we're also here to welcome our good friend, Steve Shapiro, who's going to be one of the afternoon keynote closeouts. He is one of our better speakers. We love him. He is very innovative and talks a lot about innovation and creativity, which as the more we do with the government, the more they're asking for books about innovation and creativity. I feel like they're getting that directive from the White House that they've got to come up with some more innovative ways to do things, and Steve Shapiro is going to show them how this afternoon.
What are some lessons that he tries to teach those in the federal government about innovation?
Well, he works with some very specific fun activities that he'll be telling you more about later today. But he goes around that a lot of things that we assume, like thinking outside the box, maybe that's not really what you should be doing. The title of his book is called Best Practices Are Stupid, 40 Ways to Out-Innovate the Competition. So I think people have in their mind what they think is good about innovation, and he's come up with some very unique things that you could do that are a little bit different and that definitely work. As a matter of fact, we've been working with him so much that we had an event with him about 6 weeks ago, and Hooks Book Events had a business problem. And after spending a morning with him, I applied his theory of looking at a problem in a different way. We not only solved the problem, we solved it really quickly within a week. I mean, it was incredible. So I think the book is great, and it does actually work because I used it myself.
How valuable is it to have access to people like that who are trained at solving problems at all levels of government?
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, not only our big mission with Hooks Book Events is to try to bring the smartest people we can into these government agencies for idea sharing, networking, and thought-provoking discussions. As we've said on many of these interviews, the problems these guys are facing are off the charts around the environment, around the budget, it's infinite number of problems. If we can help them come up with innovative ways to look at these problems in a different way, you might solve it. This cost me nothing to think about this problem in a different way. It was a contract negotiation. I looked at the contract negotiation in a different way based on having spent the day with Steve, and it worked. We've got a signed contract where we've got to deal with a new corporate client. But anyway, it does work, and I do believe it benefits our company when I hear these guys, but more importantly, we're hoping it benefits our clients.
And we're looking forward to speaking, of course, with Steve a little later today, coming up here soon. But what are some other things that you have going on outside of the time that you've spent with Steve?
Well, we're real excited to be bringing Chester Elton to town and to several government agencies. I believe we're doing 5 events with him in May. We're partnering with the Board of Trade May 23rd for breakfast, if anybody out there is interested in hearing him. He is a very dynamic speaker, and he's working with us with his new book called All In that will be coming out in May. And I highly recommend checking that book out for those of you trying to motivate employees and get people on the same page around your ideas. And there, again, if you're interested in hearing him, you can contact us or go to the Board of Trade website and register to have breakfast with him here at the Reagan Building May 23rd.
Talk about that motivating employees, and I'm getting a sense for that with the book title All In.
Well, he's the guy that wrote the Carrot and the Stick book, and I think his new approach, and I haven't heard him, but the full title is All In, How the Best Managers Create a Culture of Belief and Drive Big Results. His co-author is Adrian Gostick. And so he's trying to answer some of those overlooked leadership questions of the day around why some managers are able to get their employees to commit and others are not, looking at the cultures of the government and cultures of companies and figuring out how to do that.
On that note, how important is it to get buy-in from everyone in an organization to make sure that you're going in the right direction?
Oh, I think that's critical, even in a small operation. At Hooks Book Events, we've got 3 full-time and 4 part-time people. I think my business partner, Loretta Jensen, and I try very hard to have us all on the same page. We actually have a motto at our company. It's really not related to the business, but if we're all working moms, and our motto is family first. So that's our priority. We all have children. We're all in various stages of mothering, and family first is our motto. We're all on the same page about that, and we stick to that. If something comes up and you've got to do something with your family, your husband, mother, whatever, that's the priority. So we have inculcated that into our culture, and everybody there buys into it, and then we support that with our actions.
Speaking of a good friend of yours who knows something about family, Lee Woodruff, what's she up to these days?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I got an email from her this morning. She sent me her entire Google calendar for the fall. We were with her in March. Our good friend Jim Denninger at the Board of Trade worked with Bob, her cute husband Bob, and Lee on an event for Remind.org. And she's got her first fiction book coming out. And we're very excited to be working with her on that. We're going to be working with her in September. The book is called Those We Love Most. She will be in town September 12th and 13th for some private events, but there's some slots on her calendar if people are interested. Dynamic, energetic, beautiful, fun, funny. We love Lee, and we love supporting her work at Remind.org, because Hooks Book Events, we also do some stuff with our veterans, our wounded warriors, which we must all remember. So we've hooked up with Lee on that and are very excited to be working with her in her fiction book.
When you look through your roster of events coming up, what's one book that you would recommend to a federal employee who's looking to make a difference in the workplace?
I'm real excited that we've been very lucky to lasso in the very interesting behavioral economist Dan Ariely, who's got a new book out called The Honest Truth About Dishonesty. This is a behavioral economist at Duke who's very hard to secure, and we're taking him to the Securities and Exchange Commission in June. I think he always has a different look. What I like about him, he's looking at things in a different way, which is what we strive to do and what we strive to bring to our clients. So I think that one might be good. I think Chester's book, All In, might be a really good idea. And possibly, I think this new book out by Kirk Lippold, who was the commander of the USS Cole, writing his story about that. And I noticed over the weekend that some of those guys originally that blew the Cole up were killed over the weekend in a drone attack, and that's interesting because his book is coming out. I don't think it's related, but I think it's an interesting twist. I mean, talk about management under stress. I can't wait to hear what Kirk has to say.
What do you think some of the key areas would be if you're looking at an agency that wants to improve how it delivers service to the American people?
I think it takes good management from the top, and I would like to give a little shout-out brag to 2 of our clients, FDIC and the Smithsonian Institution, who are on top of that list of best places to work. I think they've got a central message. I think it's executed well. I think they inspire their employees. They also work with us. I don't know if that's a direct relationship to why they get on that, but I think it shows they're interested in educating their colleagues and their employees and bringing in smart people for them to meet, which makes me think they're taking good care of their employees on every aspect. Their budgets are under stress. These guys have a lot of guns to their head, and I think the agencies that can try to take good care of their colleagues and get them all on the same page are going to do really well.
Let's expand upon that for a minute. As you know, our AFGE members work in about 75 different agencies. How important is it to inspire the workforce to encourage them to do their very best and meet their full potential?
Well, I think that's really important because a lot of the leaders that we work with in these agencies are saying, how do we help them do more with less? The budgets are under stress. Everybody knows that. So I think bringing people in to give them specific examples of how to do that is very good. And also, I think our book events, I mean, I am going to tell you, I think people get inspired by those. I think they can't believe the agency would bring in a smart person to talk to them about how to do their job better, to say, take an hour out of your work day to come meet this person, learn a new way to do things, and get a signed copy of the book. I think it shows you care, and I think it shows you're investing in them, and I think they want to see that.
Tell me about your events. How do they operate? Take me through a scenario of an event on a typical day for you.
Well, a typical, these are private events. So we'll take one of these Nobel laureate economists or behavioral economists or an expert on leadership and management directly into a government location for a conversation. So our client agencies will invite the SES or the job grade that they want to hear the speaker. They bring them into an auditorium or a conference room. We arrive with the speaker, and there's this give and take conversation. This is the idea I'm trying to present in my book. Here's how you can implement this in your organization. There's an in-depth question and answer period. Idea sharing happens. Colleagues that within the agency start meeting each other that may not have known each other before because they're sitting in there in a conference room with somebody from HR, and there's somebody from legal, and there's somebody from another division, and they're all together around this one idea. And then we have a nice book signing. So maybe there was a burning question that you just didn't want to ask in front of your colleagues. You have an opportunity to shake the hand of a Michael Sandel or a Danny Kahneman or a Bob Shiller or some of these guys that are Dan Ariely. Ask them that burning question you've been wanting to know, and then take that, think about it, and hopefully incorporate some of that in the next day at work.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. Joined here by Perry Hooks, the president and co-founder of Hooks Book Events. Perry, what are you looking forward to most in 2012?
I'm looking forward to a robust fall of some great titles. I think we're going to see Evan Thomas, my good friend Evan Thomas, has a great book coming out on Eisenhower. Really looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to an interesting election season. We're going to New York in June to get a list of all the new wonderful books coming out. And we're already booking authors in through October right up until the day of the election. So I'm looking forward to some robust dialogue. And maybe we're going to see some interesting conversations and maybe some dialogue and good conversation coming around some of these issues where we can move this country forward.
You mentioned Evan Thomas and his book about Eisenhower. How important is it to have authors like that to talk about history and the way things were and maybe what we can learn from that?
I'm a big fan. I'm a history major, so clearly I got into the book business. I think looking at leadership through in history is critical. I think it's not the exact same. It's either the first cousin or a replica, but I do think you can see under stress what some leaders did well, what they didn't do well, and then what can you do and take that back into your own situation at your agency or maybe your own situation in your home life. I mean, what I have found over the many years of doing this, a lot of the leadership information I've learned over the years is very applicable in your home life. How are you leading in with your children? Are you leading, you know, handling yourself well as a leader in your family? But I do think some of our agencies really enjoy that. A lot of these government agencies have a lot of people on their staffs that are closet historians, I call them. They love leadership through history, and we do a lot of that when we can, and I'm looking forward to doing that with Evan.
What kind of reaction do you get from participants at your events about the authors of the day?
Unbelievable. And there's there's some anecdotes on our website under the testimonials you can read. I can't believe the government did this. That was the most exciting, the best thing I've ever heard. I'm going to take this and use it tomorrow. I mean, they thank me. They thank their colleagues that bring them in. It's amazing. I mean, it's what keeps me motivated to do it because they love it.
One of the people I noticed on your list as I was perusing earlier, Frank DeFord. Tell me what Frank's up to.
Frank, we're really excited. He's going to be, he is such a character, and I love listening to his Wednesday show on NPR. He's going to be with a new client of ours, a corporate client in Baltimore this Thursday. I've got another event here in D.C., so I'm not able to hear my business partner Loretta's going to go. He's basically has written a really fun book, but then he's also sent us like 10 or 12 topics. So the people that are going to be lucky enough to be with him are going to get to ask him kind of almost any sports question. So I've suggested everybody listen to him Wednesday. I enjoyed last Wednesday. I'm a big horse race fan, being from Tennessee, and watched the Derby. And his wonderful analysis of the Derby and the White Horse Hanson and just the whole sort of theory of the White Horse. And he's just such a clever, great, fun writer. So that's going to be a really fun event.
Perry Hooks, president and co-founder of Hooks Book Events. Perry, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Great to see you, and I hope to see you soon.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll be joined by Steve Shapiro, author of Best Practices Are Stupid, 40 Ways to Out-Innovate the Competition.
I just earned my degree at Grantham University, and now I'm on my way to a promotion.
Grantham University?
The affordable online classes fit my schedule, plus I earn college credit for work experience.
How can I fast-track my degree at Grantham University?
Go to fasttrackedu.com.
Fasttrackedu.com?
Yes, fasttrackedu.com. If you're an AFGE member, you qualify for a tuition discount. Check out Grantham University today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined now by Steve Shapiro, the author of Best Practices Are Stupid, 40 Ways to Out-Innovate the Competition. Steve, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Steve, you are a keynote speaker here today at the Excellence in Government Conference in Washington, D.C. Tell us about your book and what you're going to be doing here today.
Well, one of the themes of the conference is how do you do more with less, essentially? How do you innovate in tough times? How do you innovate with less money, less time? And I'm going to talk about just a few key concepts related to that, which, first of all, busts a couple of myths associated with innovation, things that people do that they think increase our level of innovation when, in fact, it kills it. So we're going to talk a little bit about the impact of stress on innovation and creativity, time pressure, and also look at where do we find the best solutions.
Without giving away too much, tell us some about some of that, how stress and time pressures relate to innovation and impact it.
Well, one of the big issues that happens is and I'll talk basically what I'll say in the speech, which is about the brain. And if you look at what happens in the brain, when we're under time pressure, there are certain parts of the brain that get activated, which are all about thinking, very analytical parts of the brain. They're also the judgmental parts of the brain. And the unfortunate thing is that part of the brain literally chokes off the neural pathways to the parts of the brain which creativity flows. So what will happen is when we are under stress, we will always go towards the solutions we've thought of in the past, the things that are obvious or the things that are pre-programmed, because those are the biggest neural pathways.
And what's the impact then on the best outcome?
Well, you don't get the best outcome. I mean, I always believe that expertise is the enemy of innovation, which basically means that the more you know about something, the more quickly you'll come up with an answer, yet it probably isn't new. And what we need to do is to recognize that the process of innovation and creativity involves some, it needs to relax a little bit. You need to be able to find new solutions in different places than you'd normally look. And if we always go to where we've always looked before, we're going to end up where we've always ended up.
And not every solution that worked in the past will necessarily work in the future.
Exactly. Well, that's why it's called Best Practices Are Stupid, is the main thing is that what works for one organization or one context might not work for another one. Everybody wants to replicate Apple. Guess what? They're the only Apple in the world, so trying to replicate them is ridiculous, and that's the problem.
Let's talk about maybe a path to getting to an optimal situation or an optimal outcome for a problem. How would one go about trying to find a creative solution to a particular issue?
The first step in the process is actually not to worry about the solution, but is to focus on the question. We become so enamored with jumping to the end game, to getting things done, that we don't take the time to actually step back and ponder what matters most. Good questions lead to good solutions. So, and there's a bit of an art and a bit of a science to that, but it requires some work and some time, and most people don't take the time to do that.
So how does one know what questions to ask?
Well, I always say they have to ask the right question the right way. So the which questions are the right ones requires some analysis. I mean, this is so innovation is not this wacky creative endeavor with people running around with propellers on their head. It really is a very analytical process of understanding what will make the greatest impact. And so in government, it really is what are the things we need to work on. But the second half of the equation is really important, which is not just what is the right question, but how do we frame the question in a way that will increase the likelihood of finding a solution? Most of the time, we don't take the time and invest, you know, apply the rigor to frame them in a more concrete fashion that stops the finding of solutions.
How does getting too complicated impact that path?
That's actually one of the big issues is innovation is best when it's simplification and simplification of the question. So if we need to ask the right question the right way, one of the things we need to think about is what I call the Goldilocks principle. Basically, what that means is we tend to naturally ask questions that are really big and broad, like how do we solve the financial crisis or how do we improve education? You'll never find a solution when you think of it that way. We need to deconstruct it down to things that are more solvable. On the other hand, we can't get extremely specific with questions that sort of imply a solution, which is also another thing that we tend to do. We need to get that just right mode.
What you're saying to me sounds almost like lessons we've learned in the past about how to achieve a goal and breaking it down into simple, quantifiable, achievable steps, not trying to do everything at once, not asking too broad of a question, but really trying to pare it down into things that are easy to accomplish along the way.
It's partly that, but it actually partly is about finding the leverage point. So the difference is what you're talking about with goals is we tend to take something that is a certain size and break it down so that we can eat the elephant one bite at a time is always the expression. We're not actually looking to eat the whole elephant. We're actually trying to figure out what part of the elephant is the thing that if we can fix it will have the biggest impact. So it's really about leverage more than just complete deconstruction.
There are a couple of other things that you bring up in your book, and I want to get to some of them. One focuses on the types of people that you hire. Tell us about that.
Well, I always say a little tongue-in-cheek that we want to work with and hire people that we don't like. And essentially what I mean by that is, contrary to conventional wisdom, opposites don't attract. In fact, opposites repel. I mean, we're here in D.C. There's no better place that shows where opposites repel. So if opposites repel, therefore like attracts like, we will naturally want to surround ourselves with people who think like us, have our same beliefs, our same values, and that can actually be good for efficiency, but actually kills innovation because innovation is predicated on different and divergent points of view coming together.
How important is that point, do you think, in a place like Washington, even in possibly in an administration, in a congressman's office, something like that?
It's important everywhere. I think here, just given that people have natural biases, I mean, if you look at it from a psychological perspective, there's something called confirmation bias. And basically what that says is what you believe, you will always find evidence to support it, and everything else that doesn't support what you believe will be rejected. So that is a horrible thing to have happen if we're trying to innovate, because basically all you're going to do is, first of all, it's not very good for collaboration, because if you can't hear what someone else is saying, then they have no vested interest in working with you. So this is a perfect place for the people to understand and recognize their biases, to really actively seek out people who think differently, people who may annoy them for that reason, but at the same time at least try to value what they contribute.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Steve Shapiro, the author of Best Practices Are Stupid, 40 Ways to Out-Innovate the Competition. Steve, after you get through hiring people, how about ideas? Talk about the ideas that you've come up with for the book.
Well, everybody's really enamored with ideas these days. If I go into an organization, everybody has some kind of suggestion box or idea competition, and the reality is asking for ideas is a bad idea. And the reason is we create so much noise. And if the theme, as this conference is about efficiency, asking everybody for their thoughts, opinions, and suggestions creates a lot of noise and a lot of wasted time. That's why the question becomes really important, because that helps us focus on what matters most.
There's this idea that we talk about in solving problems about thinking outside the box, and you have some thoughts on that.
Yes, and in fact, I have a nice cartoon that I like, which is a picture of a cat inside of a litter box who's saying that I do my best thinking inside the box. And I actually think that's quite apt, because we've done some studies on this, and there's enough evidence to prove that thinking outside the box when it comes to finding solutions, when it comes to asking lots of first opinions and suggestions, create so much noise and so much irrelevancy of solutions. So instead of thinking outside the box, what we want to do is find a better box. What we want to do is ask those better questions that will help harness the energies of the organization and get people laser focused. That is actually the key. Now, if we want to, we could think outside the box when it comes to the problem or question that we're going to work on, but not the solution.
Another key point here is this idea of failure. People many times are afraid to fail. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I know inside the innovation world, we now have this glamorization of failure, and I actually don't think that we want to glamorize it as much as we do. I mean, yes, there's an expression that failure is always an option. On the other hand, if we do it right, we don't have to fail. I always view innovation through the lens of experimentation. I'm an engineer, and I always look at things through the scientific method, which basically says, let's create a small, scalable experiment. And when we run the experiment, we will either prove or disprove the hypothesis. The only way an experiment fails is if we could not prove or disprove our hypothesis. If we disprove the hypothesis, that's actually one of the best things because we can kill things that aren't going to add value. Then we want to scale those experiments. So failure only happens when we don't get the information we need.
If you don't succeed, try and try again?
Well, maybe, but there's better and more efficient ways to do that, especially with collaborative innovation, open innovation, and crowdsourcing. You have the ability now to put the risk of innovation into the marketplace and create a massive parallel process where you as an organization don't have to pay for successes and failures. The market will. They will do all the work.
As you said, you're an engineer, came from the corporate world. How have some of these points helped you along the way in some situations that you encountered in your own work life?
I'm always trying to rethink what I am doing. In fact, I'm going through that process right now. And it really comes down to what I've learned more than anything else is to take the time. So if I'm busy, I realize that I can't innovate. The second thing is I really need to get masterful at asking the right question. And I know that sounds like a broken record, but the reality is sometimes I get caught up in things that feel fun, they seem sexy, but at the end of the day, they're not really important. So by figuring out what is important to me and my business, then what I can do is figure out what's important to the marketplace and connect those two together. What will create value outside, what creates value inside, and connect those together.
You had mentioned sometimes we're just so busy. How do we strip that stuff away and focus on the things that really, really matter?
Well, it's a really good discipline to get into the habit of is, first of all, just allocating some time in the beginning of the day to do two things. One is to clear the mind. I mean, we know our best thinking takes place when we're in the shower, when we're napping, when we're meditating, and that's when our creative ideas happen. So we need to do some of that. The other thing is also to get clear on what are we going to do today that's going to help move things forward. Even if it's just figuring out what are the three things that I'm going to do that could take 5 minutes each. But if I could do three things that only take 5 minutes each day, by the end of the year, I've done 600 different types of things that are going to make an impact on what I'm doing. And there's this cumulative impact that this has over time. So it's not always thinking about big. It's also just doing small things and chipping away at it.
How does staying organized fit into some of the things that you're doing?
Well, I'm actually not very organized. Creative people tend to be naturally messy. So I need to organize my time. I mean, I really don't. I mean, my physical space, maybe not so organized because, in fact, it serves as a source of connections. You know, if, as Steve Jobs said, creativity is just having enough dots to connect. You go to my workspace, there's a lot of dots all over the place. But I need to organize my time. And again, it's that process of figuring out what matters, doing these rituals. I call them rituals. Have a ritual every single day. I wake up, I have tea, I sit down, and I will spend at least 30 minutes. Sometimes it takes less, actually, but I try to spend 30 minutes and figure out what are the things I'm going to do today that are going to make impact that I can actually complete today. And then what are the things I need to start thinking about? What are the questions I haven't pondered? And then I start accumulating these, and after a period of time, you get some incredible insights.
How has that served you along the way in your career, following those points?
Well, I describe my life and path through everything I do as meandering with purpose. So I definitely, I have a book called Goal-Free Living, so I really don't have goals. I've never tried to figure out where I'm going to be in 5 years, but I've always had a sense of direction. And what I really try to do is, if you look at where I've ended up versus where I thought I would end up, they're very, very different. But it's what a good innovator does. It's constantly taking in new information every day. It's not saying, I've got a plan, let's go implement it. But it's rather stepping back and saying, okay, each day, what have I learned? How do I change direction slightly? And those very small incremental changes can actually lead you in fundamentally different places. I mean, I never thought I was going to write a book on poker with poker cards in it. Personality poker is, that wasn't one of my plans. But that happened actually by allowing some connections. I was in Las Vegas and I was playing blackjack, and I made this connection between personality styles and poker cards, and so that's how I do it.
That is actually a very interesting book, which we have taken a look at. It is a book with a deck of poker cards attached to it. Can you just tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. Well, you talked about the hire people you don't like, and that really is based on that principle. There are four steps in the innovation process, which is define the problem or challenge, generate solutions, plan and execute, and then engage the hearts and minds of people. Each of those steps correlates to very specific personality behaviors and styles and traits that people have. So personality poker is a deck of 52 poker cards with suits, colors, and numbers, like regular poker cards, but they also have words, like organized, creative, visionary, analytical. And we go through this process of trading cards. The objective is to get five cards where the words best describe how you see yourself. So you could see yourself as being creative and visionary and experiential. And based on the suits, the colors, and the numbers that you end up with in your hand, will tell you everything you want to know about how you contribute to innovation, how you detract from innovation, what your innovation blind spots are, and who you should partner with to make innovation a reality.
Do you believe that everyone is innovative or has the potential to be?
Absolutely, 100%. They just contribute to innovation in a different way. So some people really have a very analytical lens when it comes to innovation. Again, if asking the right question is the most important step in innovation, those aren't the wacky creative people. Those are the very analytical, scientifically oriented people. So everybody has a contribution to innovation. They just think about it differently. They might not be creative the way we tend to think of it, which is just a step in the innovation process.
Do you think some people get discouraged if they think they're not innovative?
Some people, I don't think, care if they're innovative. I mean, because it's just maybe do their daily work. They're just happy to do what they do. They don't see the value in it. So I think where people become frustrated is when they aspire to something more than they are, and they believe that being creative is something which could help them. But most organizations, unfortunately, don't value that. So for a lot of people, they just become sort of disengaged and don't really want to put the energy in, which is unfortunate because tapping into that passion that people have is the key.
On that notion of trying to be more than you are, how do you figure out who you are, what you're good at?
What you're good at is different than who you are. One important thing. So when we play personality poker, I always try to make sure that people understand you choose cards that best describe not what you're good at, but best describe who you are when you're in the flow, like when things are good. And you can really look at aspects of your life, not just at work, to get a good sense of that. We are our best barometer. Now, I have developed with Harvard this test that people can take, which actually tests your subconscious mind, which is really fascinating stuff. So that is actually the only way to do something like that. But the reality is you want to look at yourself, but then have conversations with other people. The great thing with personality poker is people can give you cards. They can gift you cards. Hey, I think you're anal retentive, which, by the way, is the three of clubs. That's very interesting to at least see. It doesn't tell you who you are, but it tells you what your behaviors are. And that is really important for understanding yourself.
Maximizing then your potential, right?
Absolutely, because you really want to triangulate between how others see you, how you see yourself at a conscious level, and how you see yourself at a subconscious level. And when you actually understand all three of those, because the subconscious level tells you who you will go to when you're really stressed. That's like when you have no other way to go, that's where you'll go. So understanding how you consciously think about yourself, which is not stressed, to how you are when you're stressed versus how others perceive you gives you a great lens.
How important is it to be adaptable and open to change?
To me, that is the key. And when people ask me my definition of innovation, I tell the old joke about trying to outrun the bear. I mean, if you know that one, it's like, I don't need to outrun you. I only need to outrun the bear. Or, I don't need to outrun the bear. I need to only outrun you. Blew that joke. but that to me is the key, is this is not about innovation for innovation's sake. It's not about ideas. It really is about adaptability. And what I love is if you study sort of what Darwin said, he never said it was survival of the fittest. He said it was survival of the adaptable. That is the key. It is not about having the most money. It's not about having the most contacts. It's not about being the best looking. Whatever it is, it's not about any of those things, because at some point, somebody will beat you at that game. Adaptability is the key.
Steve Shapiro, the author of Best Practices Are Stupid, 40 Ways to Out-Innovate the Competition. Steve, great talking with you today.
Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you to our guest this week, OurFuture.org Executive Editor Isaiah Poole, Congressman Jerry Connolly, Hooks Book Events President Perry Hooks, and Steve Shapiro, author of Best Practices Are Stupid, 40 Ways to Out-Innovate the Competition. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, MetLife, and Grantham University.